We're back on Fictional Frontiers. It's James Berardinelli time on Fictional Frontiers. James is the founder of RealViews.net. He is the best online film critic in America, and this is his Real Takes segment with us. And James, storms in the background.
Yeah, what was it? What was it that Snoopy said? It was a dark and stormy evening.
Yes, but this is an afternoon, right?
Well, yeah. I mean,
I know what you're saying. I know what you're...
Although when you look outside, it looks like it's evening right now.
Well, in South Jersey, in the Philadelphia area, we've been having some very, I don't want to say odd weather, but I would say atypical weather over the last couple of weeks with just this, constant heat, this heat wave that's very humid, and you know, it's hot during the day, and then all of a sudden when these storms arrive, we know why they're so fierce, because it's just so hot in the humidity, and it's just the, you know, hot and cold air kind of, you know, clashing against each other. And so I would argue that it's loud outside, but online, among the forums, among the chats, particularly coming from people like LeBron James, there's a lot of online thunder as well. And we're going to talk about Space Jam: A New Legacy, because...
Do we have to?
Well, I want to... I think there's a lot to talk about here. I know it sounds like there's not, but I think this one tweet kind of sums up the modern discourse with respect to pop culture in many respects. And I'm going to pull it up right now, because it was after the opening weekend's box office totals came out, and... It's interesting because you and I have been working in this industry for so long, we kind of know how this works. You know, you have a great first week typically, and then the bottom drops out, right? And obviously Black Widow did not do anywhere near as well as, you know, people thought. Although I think given the circumstances, the fact that Black Widow's on Disney Plus, even though you have to pay $30 for it,
falling from $80 million to $26 million. You know, that's par for the course for a superhero movie like that. And when you amp up the fact that, you know, with COVID being the way it is now, you're gonna have the diehards are all gonna go out on the first weekend. You're not gonna get the same. Typically, what Marvel has relied on is a huge surge of diehards the first weekend. And then the second and third weekends, maybe fourth weekend, then you get the people who like the MCU but don't necessarily feel compelled to see it the first weekend that it's out.
Right.
Well, what you're seeing with this film is, first of all, the overall profile of the audience is down. $80 million is great for the circumstances that we're in right now.
I would agree.
It would have been terrible if it opened with that, X number of, two or three years ago, if it, that those numbers would have been disappointing.
Do you think
we
so?
We still don't know what the dampening factor is.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think they are still terrible, given the fact, or it would have been terrible, even though it's a prequel film, and it's a film that's not really, you know, moving the narrative forward as far as the MCU is concerned? Because I would argue, and I agree with you, I think, you know, $80 million in relation to, say, the Iron Man films or the Captain America films, yes, the numbers are not
bang.
Great. Yeah, I can hear that bang back there as well. Like I said, thunder outside, thunder online. But, you know, I've talked to some people about it. They said, listen, you know, I think the numbers are really strong because this is the first time that Marvel's actually made a film that was not essential viewing regardless of the character, because, you know, we've had Endgame. We know what happens in the past. It kind of goes back to what you were talking about with respect to prequels.
Yeah, but here's the double whammy on this.
Okay.
It is a familiar character. We're not talking about an obscure character like Ant-Man that only, you know, followers of the comic... I mean, Black Widow is a firm member of the Avengers cast. Putting aside the Spider-Man movie, this is the first post-Avengers movie we've seen, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The first post-Avengers movie from Disney. I think if you factor all that together, and generally speaking, had this come out and not been delayed, there would have been a lot more excitement for it, simply because it was, you know, the first post-Avengers movie. Mm-hmm. There would have been a lot of interest in it just on that basis. Now, you know, some of that excitement or anticipation has dulled, But I still think that you are comparing $80 million to something greater than $100 million.
Correct, right.
I don't know what that number is. Nobody knows what that number is. And you can argue back and forth. You can't. And then the fact that it's on Disney Plus as well, mm-hmm. although you have to pay $30 for it,
right.
further muddies the waters. So you really have no clue what this movie is doing.
And you made a great point. You were mentioning the fact that this is the first, or it would have been the first, post-Endgame Marvel film. But when you talk about the other Disney Plus content, we've had three series now on Disney Plus that are Marvel-related. You know, we had WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, and Loki. And so, again, that adds to the fatigue as well, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if Black Widow had come out when it was intended to come out, that would have been before any of the...
yes, right.
That would have been before WandaVision, which was the first one. So the everything would have been different. And so you can't really compare. You can't say whether it's doing well, it's not doing well. It's doing what it's doing.
Right.
We will find out, I think, when we get to Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
what the real ceiling is.
Okay.
Because Spider-Man, No Way Home, is not being released to a streaming service, at least not within the first 40 days that it's out.
Mm-hmm.
It is by far the most anticipated movie of the year, probably the most anticipated movie since Endgame. And they're doing a great job of guerrilla marketing about with that film, with all of these rumors that Sony or Kevin Feige, whoever's running the publicity for this, has done a really... some of these rumors, I believe, have been seeded by this studio.
Okay.
And the studio has done a lot of non-denial denials. So what you're getting is you're getting rumors, many of which will not turn out to be true, some of which probably will turn out to be true. Rumors mixed with facts, everything just stirring the pot, getting people excited, getting people interested. So, and then hopefully, we don't know, of course, COVID will be in a lull by December, although one has to wonder if that's really going to be the case. But, mm-hmm. All these kind will, in all likelihood, result in giving us a ceiling. What's the new ceiling? What can the movie make? I think that movie, had it come out pre-COVID with all of the same attendant interest and so on and so forth, might have gone for about a $200,000 to $250,000 first weekend.
You mean $250 million? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And as a result, what are we going to look at now? Are we going to look at, is it going to be 150? Is it going to be 200? Is it going to be 250? Could it be 300? We'll see. But all the other movies between now and then are, relatively speaking, small fries. The Bond movie, which is, certainly a significant release, isn't really in the same league. Bond, people, I think, have this belief that Bond is bigger than he actually is.
Mm.
I mean, it's not to diminish how much that franchise has made over the years, but not since the Connery days has Bond been a global juggernaut.
Correct.
And even Skyfall, I think it only made, about $500-600 million worldwide?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it just got to $200 million in the United States. That's nice territory, but it's not gargantuan MCU blockbuster territory. So you might, Bond will provide a data point, but it will not give us the ceiling. So we have to wait for Spider-Man for the ceiling. Now, in terms of, so I think the number for Black Widow is not to me shocking, and not really, I shouldn't be disappointing either, because if you looked at 80 million, a fall to about 30 million is about what you would have expected. You know, you're not getting as much of interest from the sort of non-diehard crowd. And I think the diehards are not going back to see it a second time.
Correct.
That's where the Disney Plus factor may come in.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people want to see it in the theater once. And if they feel the desire to see it a second time, then they may go blow the $30 on the Disney Plus surcharge and watch it at home and watch it as many times as they want. I don't think Disney Plus hurts the first weekend bottom line box office that much. I think it hurts the subsequent weekend bottom line box office a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because now your casual viewer, instead of going out to see it on the second weekend, pays the $30 and watches it on the first weekend at home. So I think that that's where you're seeing the impact of that surcharge. I think if this had not been released on Disney Plus, I don't think it would have done a lot better theatrically the first weekend. Maybe 85, maybe 88 million, something like that. Second weekend, though, I think would have done closer to about 40, 45, you know, less than a 50, less than 100% drop off. You know, where does it go from here? I think it's going to flirt with 200 million domestic, which is, I think, a very good number for this film.
Okay.
And
globally,
what is it going to get on Disney Plus? Those are numbers we're never going to see because Disney is not releasing them. So we don't know. We don't know what it's really doing on Disney Plus. But what I will say is, this is a test case for Disney and Marvel, and they are going to evaluate the numbers that Black Widow generates very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, they're going to make some decisions about where to go for future MCU releases.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not the big juggernaut, the one where the new Avengers and the Fantastic Four fight Galactus. I don't really see that being released on, you know, streaming the same weekend that it goes to theaters. But some of the other movies, I'm actually a little surprised that they haven't made a move with Shang-Chi, and maybe it's just, maybe they are going to make that move. I think that's going to end up streaming the same weekend that it opens theatrically.
Mm. Really?
Now, they made the move with the Jungle Cruise based on what they saw as strength in Cruella.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at the numbers for Cruella and said, you know, we think Jungle Cruise overall, you know, if we handle it the same way.
Well, I want to get back to the film I know you love, which is Space Jam: A New Legacy, and I want to circle back to that tweet, which I did find. It's not a long tweet, but Space Jam did pretty well the first weekend, better than expected at the box office, right? I think it ended up making around $31 million at the box office, but the reviews were horrible. And look, I saw the film on HBO Max. I didn't go out and pay extra to see it. I didn't think it was the worst thing I'd ever seen. I think some of the reviews were hyperbolic beyond belief. I think the main problem or the main reason behind that was because the crass approach to Warner Brothers pushing in every single intellectual property into the film and, you know, bringing in all of these characters. And it was almost like a "We are Warner Brothers, hear us roar." It was vomitous. It was just overwhelming. I think that really turned people off from the very beginning. And I think, you know, had they gone with a pared down story, something that was more in the spirit of the first Space Jam, I don't think it would have been eviscerated as it was by the critics. Yes, it would have still been rotten most likely by most critics' marks. But I think for kids, you know, it's okay. It's passable entertainment. But what I found rather, you know, rather interesting and pretty funny, actually, and I think it also shows that people who are not in the industry don't really understand it. LeBron James himself tweeted after the opening weekend, "Hi, haters," and he posted a link to Deadline talking about how Space Jam kind of stole the ball away from Black Widow. And I don't think he realizes what's coming in the second and third weeks, right? I think it goes back to what you were talking about with respect to Black Widow. I think that, yes, $31 million, you could argue, is a kind of a respectable total. But for a film like this, which probably with the marketing and with the budget was north of $200 million easily, maybe $250, it's going to be in the red no matter what. I mean, that's pretty much a given. So
yeah, I mean, I would think that this film, especially with the NBA Finals kind of ending all interest in basketball.
Right, last
night. Now that they're over.
I was happy Milwaukee won, by the way. Small market. I love seeing small market teams win. So
you know, now that
but it could have been the Sixers. It could have been the Sixers. We believe.
Yeah, I don't see that that film doing much better, totaling up like the $50 to $60 million domestic range, which is, I think, considerably below what they were hoping for when they greenlit it.
Well, he just doesn't know the industry, right? When he's, you know, I guess, yes, you can stick your chest out for that one weekend, but he doesn't understand the long game, I guess, with respect to the film industry, because again, it's not about the first weekend.
Star Trek V won its first weekend.
That's all you need to know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the first weekend, accolades you get when you see something like this. I can't tell you, there have been probably, hundreds and hundreds of movies that have won that opening weekend, and then we find out that they were colossal failures, right? That's what it comes down to. So I don't think he understands it. But the film itself, I mean, when you see a film like Space Jam, A New Legacy, I read your review, you gave it 2 stars. How do you review a film like that? Because you and I know that these films are not made for us. But at the same time, we do have a right to critique, a film like this, because when you compare it to, say, a film by Miyazaki, or you compare it to a Pixar film where you see entertainment that's for kids, that's produced at a very high level, we have a right to critique it. It's not just about being, quote-unquote, a hater, right?
No, as with anything, I mean, you can't pigeonhole any individual into, you can only review these movies because they're in your wheelhouse. Such a thing is fundamentally dishonest. A movie is a movie regardless of, what demographic it might primarily be targeting. So you write what your honest reaction to the movie is. So the first Space Jam, I didn't like a whole lot more than I like this one.
Same.
In fact, I started out my review saying that it was just basically a 90-minute commercial, eulogizing Michael Jordan.
Yes, that's what it was, yes.
And this one, you know, for whatever the comparison is worth, I think LeBron James actually, in the acting department, comes across better than Jordan or Shaq.
I would agree with that, too.
Now, I'm not saying he's going to win an Oscar, but he at least doesn't appear like completely wooden throughout the film.
He looks like he's trying, too.
Yeah, but the movie itself, there's nothing there. There's no story there. So, you know, I was thinking of you, actually, when I was watching
it. Okay, I want to hear this, yeah.
Because they are in a video game.
Yes.
So I immediately thought of Tron, and then I know you love Tron. So I was thinking that how disgusted you must be by, the opportunities here to do something, along the line. This movie there were so many opportunities to do really interesting things, and of course they took none of them.
Right.
I mean, the idea, just the whole idea of being trapped in a video game, of having to outwit the AI, of all these different things that they could have done but didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Warner Brothers cartoon characters, nobody's even talking about them because, well, frankly, they aren't all that memorable insofar as the movie is concerned. I don't know. Warner Brothers seems to kind of want to make them relevant, and yet hasn't really put any real effort into making them relevant. And I'm not sure they can be made relevant.
Well, I think that's a very, very interesting observation. I thought.
The way I concluded the review was advocating that rather than trying to make them relevant for today's audiences, just hermetically seal them in the past where they were created, and let people enjoy them on their own terms to the extent that they want to enjoy them. They're never going to be big again. You can't make them big again because time has moved, people have moved, attitudes have changed. So you leave you leave those characters, those cartoons. There are hundreds, thousands of those Looney Tunes cartoons. You make them available to people so that those people who want to watch them, it may not be a very large audience, but they can access them. It's the same way with almost every the TV show or many of the movies that were made in olden days. It's the same thing. You can't try to, you know, make Casablanca relevant by remaking it with, I don't know, whoever the flavor of the month is.
Right.
That
right.
doesn't work. I mean, the film exists on its own merits. And you either have to appreciate it for what it is. This is kind of the anti-remake argument. The argument for remakes is that every generation deserves their own version of a story, which I think is ludicrous because once you've committed a story to film or tape or whatever, once it's recorded and therefore available, there is no need to create a new version for another generation. And rarely does it work.
Right.
There are occasions when it does. I'd say 90 to 95% of the time when you talk about a movie, people, when they think of that, are thinking about the original, not the remake.
I agree with you 100%. And I'll do you one better. I think one of the other reasons why the Looney Tunes, new iterations, these new versions of these characters, this trying to recapture the magic and spirit of that time doesn't work is because those creators are no longer around. Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, these giants in animation. And, I have done a lot of reading and research.
Well, last time Mel Blanc voiced the characters, I believe, was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Well, there you go. And the thing is, and I'm not saying that people back in the day did not do things for a profit, but the Looney Tunes cartoons, they're really masterpieces because they weren't being designed or made to sell toys or to push some licensing or branding campaign. It wasn't about other verticals. It was about producing the funniest short possible. And they work so well because there's a purity to the art. And I feel like with Space Jam, A New Legacy, and a lot of the Looney Tunes, toys and games and shows that have come since then. I mean, Animaniacs is a little bit different. But a lot of these efforts, there's not a purity of intent. It's obviously trying to mine that IP. Like you said, it's trying to go back to the well. And it's not even going back to the well for the right reason, quote unquote. It's going there to simply make a profit. And I think that's what really turns people off, because to me it's like these are zombie versions of the original characters. I mean, did you feel that way? I mean, I did not feel that this was Bugs Bunny. I did not feel that this was Daffy Duck. They were brilliant because even in the shorts back in the day, they did have their taglines or their catch lines or, these little things they would do consistently. But I don't need to see callbacks in this film, because to me that was not happening in the organic flow of what we were seeing in the short. So to me, it's a colossal failure when you do something like that. And like you said, people are not talking about that. But in answer to your question about how I felt as far as the Tron versions of things and how things just did not you know, really take advantage of the medium. It's very clear they've spent a lot of money on this, and they have the technology. But again, this is another example of how many, many people are technically savvy and they have skill sets, but they lack imagination. And I'm just being completely blunt here. One of the things that I don't like to see is a lack of verisimilitude in these types of films. I think that even in the game itself, I know Looney Tunes are crazy, and that's supposed to be kind of one of the points of the way the game plays out. By the way, Don Cheadle, you know, he really was into the role. I'll give him that. Okay, I didn't think he was that bad. He was actually probably the most entertaining part of the movie for me. But I don't really enjoy films, and I think kids don't either enjoy films as much when there's no rhyme or reason to the game itself. I mean, I know they're trying to score X, Y, and Z. And in the context of the Looney Tunes, like you've said before, I mean, those shorts, they take place in that, you know, Acme-centric world. Here, this is, you know, a basketball game in a computer that's being made by an AI. If you talk to kids today, they'd like to understand the rules of the game. My son was like, what is this? I don't understand what's going on. And these are video gamers. I mean, gamers, again, I think, like I said, there's this disconnect between the people who are making these films and actually even gamers themselves, because if you play any video games at all, there are very, you know, clear rules of engagement in those games. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. It's not like it's just madness running around. Minecraft, you know, there is creativity involved, but clear rules. And I think that this film failed, you know, utterly on that level. The one thing I wanted to ask you about, though, James, that really, really bothered me. I wonder if it bothered you. I mean, it may have been the worst thing about the film as a whole. Now, you know, on the sidelines, they have the cameos of all the characters, right? So the thing that was so disturbing to me, and maybe it's because I've gone to so many, you know, cons, and, you know, I've been to San Diego Comic-Con so many times and moderated events there, and I've, you know, seen the amazing cosplayers, and a lot of the costumes they make are better than what you see on the screens from, you know, the Hollywood productions. You know, you see Batman from 1966, you see Robin from 1966. How disturbing was it to see a Robin who was supposed to be Burt Ward, but it seemed to be a geriatric version of Burt Ward, you know, like a cheap cosplay version of Robin cheering or screaming in the background? I mean, why include him if you can't have an accurate version of Robin, or maybe you use the technology to CG him in?
Yeah, I don't know what all that was about. I mean, you had King Kong, who I guess looked like King Kong.
Kind of.
And then you had this other weird thing who looked like, a version of King Kong before they had actually put the hair on him or something like
right,
that.
Right. I think that was actually, if I'm not mistaken, that might have been one of the Hanna-Barbera characters.
It turned into this thing, and I'm sure this was fun for the animators. See how many Warner Brothers IP, how much IP you can get into it. See if you can scram. I mean, maybe it would be, like I said, it's like a drinking game, but freeze frame it and go through and every character, I'm sure, was pulled out of some movie, except for the ones that are specific to this movie.
Well, I mean, they included I'm just going to be blunt, the rapist from A Clockwork Orange in there. I mean, they're in the
Droogs.
Yeah, the Droogs. I mean, who would include, I mean, what would possess
Pepe Le Pew couldn't be included.
Right. how strange is that? What kind of dissonance?
Yeah, they can't include Pepe Le Pew because he runs afoul of the Me Too movement, I guess. I don't know. But
you can include the Droogs, you know, like you said.
But I always thought the thing with Pepe Le Pew was that was sort of satirizing.
Right, that's what I thought. I thought it was a
that
mockery.
That sort of personality, that French ladies' man.
Right, exactly. That
was like a huge satire of it. And people, they don't understand satire. John Cleese made this point.
Mm.
When they were complaining about one of his Fawlty Towers episodes, I believe it was, there was a line in there about where he was being treated by a black doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the comment, "Don't touch me, I don't know where you've been." Mm. And so they, there were the episode was called The Germans.
Okay.
And it was, you know, offensive to just about everybody. They were offensive to Germans, offensive to ugly women, offensive to, but it was, you know, it's like he wakes up and he says, my God, you're ugly, to this nurse who's taking care of him. And she says, I'll go get the doctor. And he says, you don't need a doctor, dear. You need a plastic surgeon. So John Cleese was, he made this point. He said that this is satire.
Mm-hmm.
We are not intended to identify with Basil Fawlty. We're supposed to look at him and be shocked that there's a person who could actually hold those particular beliefs.
Exactly.
But Basil Fawlty and Archie Bunker were very much, you know, in the same, you know, playroom.
Mm-hmm.
And the intentions were the same. But we as a society have become so overly sensitive,
mm-hmm,
that satirical commentary, which is actually very scathing toward people who do not have, who are not open to diversity and so on and so forth, that gets lost on them. And they take things that are not meant to be taken seriously, and they, you know, sort of believe them at face value, and that's a problem with what's happening to the entertainment industry in general. This oversensitivity and the potentially negative commercial ramifications of it are causing filmmakers to self-neuter in some very important areas, and we are losing films that have edgy satire.
Exactly. Well, James, we have a lot to talk about. We just kind of wanted to at least address the Space Jam phenomenon. And again, we're not haters, LeBron. I do think that the message of the film relating to parents being overbearing did kind of resonate with me a little bit. I was talking to my brother-in-law about that, who has a young son who's playing very well in the junior tennis ranks or in those tournaments.
Again, I thought it could have been done in a lot more interesting fashion.
Yes,
this idea that this kid basically does not want to do what his father wants him to do. He doesn't want that career,
right,
and his father is deaf to that. That could be the basis of a much more interesting story than the one that's told here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, most definitely. Well, you know, I guess, like I said, we went in with low expectations. We kind of got what we expected. And look, LeBron, I mean, look, you know, I'm glad he's moving into other things. I hope what he learns from this experience is that, yes, you know, you do have the resources, you do have the contacts. Let's just go for, you know, something a little bit meatier, a little bit, you know, more well-rounded. And like I said, it was not Space Jam, the first one. Wasn't as bad as that. I actually thought it was better than the first one. I think kids will enjoy it to a degree, but if we're being, you know, completely honest and comparing it to films in that same genre, subgenre, it just doesn't, you know, pass the muster. But James, we'll talk next week. I know we're going to talk about Old, which I'm hearing a lot of really good things about from one of our regional creators, M. Night Shyamalan. And yeah, I'm really curious to see what you're going to think about that or what you're going to say about that. And the film I do want to see the most, and I don't know if it's going to be available for you know, review online, is The Green Knight. I don't know if you're interested in that film, but I'm hearing
The Green Knight is not going to be available for review on, but there is a screening of it.
Okay. Are you looking forward to that one at all, or what do you think?
Yeah, okay. I'll be seeing it next week.
Okay. In the theater?
Yes, in the theater.
All right, James. Well, listen, I'm glad you survived Space Jam. I guess, you know, maybe we were in the game as well. We just, you know, unfortunately escaped. You know, I don't know. I don't know how many people, I don't know if it was the whole world was supposed to be in the game, because the AI was kind of pulling people from all over, but we did escape, you know, Space Jam.
Yeah, so we escaped. So that's because we got caught up in Thanos' snap. So.
Yes. We live to fight another day. Again, James Burrell, the founder of RealViews.net, the best online film critic in America. James, we'll talk Old next week, and yeah, we'll see what else is on the horizon. And we're back in Fictional Frontiers. It's said that there are only a handful of stories that can and do exist. that it's simply how the stories are told that changes. I would argue that although our common humanity does lead to echoes of sameness, it's the diversity in the manifestation of things that truly leads to something unique. And in the case of the novel, The Lady or the Lion, there's something that's not only unique in the way it's presented, it's a lot of fun as well. And I just want to welcome Amna Qureshi to our program today to talk about her debut novel. Amna, thanks again for taking the time. Welcome to Fictional Frontiers.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Amna, I want to first start by looking at how you made this leap into publishing. A lot of authors have different roads to success or to actually getting into the industry. And the first, I guess you could say, foray into that, the first step is actually developing a certain level of confidence and belief that you could do it. So talk about those first steps, those first stages, and how actually as you made your way in, it was more about not only honing your craft, but also gaining the necessary experience.
Yeah, that's definitely true that you need to have a certain level of confidence to even venture into this industry because it is so difficult and brutal to break through in. I actually think I had the benefit of starting really young where I hadn't even begun to doubt myself yet. So that sort of worked out for me where I sort of always had that confidence. And actually, it wasn't until I started looking into the publishing process and, you know, started reaching out to agents and various publishers that that confidence sort of waned a little bit as, you know, I heard back rejections and various critiques. So that was definitely something that I struggled with and really had to hold on to, the belief that I had in myself and in my work. I was always pretty confident in my writing, but of course, you know, hearing rejections and not getting a lot of positive feedback from people will really wear you down. But I think something that really helped for me was always just remembering why I was writing and sort of grounding myself with the process and just how much I love writing. So for me, you know, writing was sort of just an extension of my love for reading. I really wanted to recreate that, you know, wonderful euphoria people feel after reading a really good book. And I was able to do that through writing, and it was such a fun hobby of mine. And then when I started looking into getting published, of course, it wasn't as fun, you know, to reach out to people. Right. But just remembering how much I loved it really helped ground me and center me.
So with respect to the medium itself, obviously you said you love reading, and that was kind of the impetus for you taking the step, making this leap. Was there ever a point where you said, you know what, maybe I'm not necessarily geared towards writing novels. Maybe I'm more, you know, in line with someone who would be in an industry like film or television or screenplay writing or plays or what have you. What made you realize that novels were the format for you?
That's a great question. Yeah, I never considered anything other than novels. And actually, even in novels, I think I'm very picky where I really only read fiction. I barely read nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Even for school, when we had to read it, it never interested me as much. And even in fiction that I really only read full-length novels rather than short stories. So really, that was the only thing that I ever really truly enjoyed. And because I read so much, I felt like I had a lot of experience in that genre and that industry. So to write for, you know, for that specific type of industry, I felt like was much easier for me. So I never considered going into screenplay writing or anything like that because I've never read it, so I feel like I wouldn't have any experience to really go about it in a successful way.
And if you're trying to write something that's authentic, it's said that you should pull from your life, from your background, from your culture, your experience. And what's amazing about this novel is that you actually pull from all of that. But I would even go further and say that it wasn't just about what you already knew, but it was about what you learned as well when you visited Pakistan. So talk about that, because you know, on the one hand, you were pulling from those things you were familiar with, but it was really those visits to Pakistan in the past and what you learned on those trips that really kind of sent you on this journey as well.
Yes, definitely. I mean, of course, growing up as a Pakistani-American, growing up as a Muslim, there was so much of the culture and religion already in my life. But just like you said, it wasn't until I really visited Pakistan and learned so much more that I was really able to be even more inspired for this novel that I wanted to write. So, and a lot of times too, when we visit Pakistan, you know, I really only stay with my family. We don't really travel around the country as much. So it can seem a bit, you know, as a second home, it can seem maybe not as exciting.
Right.
So I think that's why at first I wasn't, you know, as inspired by it. But then in the summer of 2017, actually, when we visited, my mom planned this whole trip for us to visit the northern areas, which I had never been to before. And when we went, it was like this two-week road trip throughout the northern areas. And we started from Islamabad, and we drove all the way to the China border.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, like, completely floored by how beautiful the country is, by, you know, the nature, the landscape, just all of this beauty and these incredible sights that I hadn't even realized were, you know, basically in my backyard, you know. I always visited Pakistan growing up, but we had never even seen all of these things. So, you know, during that trip, I was really incredibly inspired, and I found it to be such a beautiful backdrop that I thought would fit the novel that I wanted to write really well, and it was something that I really wanted to share with people. I feel like, you know, Pakistan gets, you know, a lot of bad media, so I really, it was sort of coming from a place of, you know, if people could see what I'm seeing right now, you know, they would love this country as much as I do.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I just saw a trailer for the movie The Eternals yesterday, and it's a Marvel film, and there's one character in there who is supposed to be this spacefaring alien, and evidently, from what I've read, he's also a quote-unquote Bollywood star. They always seem to fall into the stereotype, so to speak. If someone's from a South Asian background, they naturally are a Bollywood inclined actor or a protagonist, so to speak, or someone who, you know,
right,
stays in those spaces. And what I love about your novel, even for myself, is that you really pull from so many different areas in our rich tradition that we either have forgotten or have neglected to learn. So was that something you were aware of as you were writing the novel, even before you started the process of actually putting words to paper?
Yeah, definitely. So actually, when I first started drafting this novel, I didn't even consider, you know, drawing from my own culture or my own religion or anything like that. When I started writing, I was sort of mimicking a bit of what I had already seen in the industry, which was very Western inspired fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
But then after my trip to Pakistan, you know, I was so inspired, and I realized that I was, you know, the only one holding myself back from writing a book that I would have loved to see growing up. And then as I started writing it, you know, I really just had so much fun exploring, like, all these different aspects of culture, you know, the food, the clothes, like, the scenery, the way that people interact, all of these things I had so much fun exploring. And I definitely do agree that, you know, in media, a lot of times when those stories aren't told by, you know, the people who are from those cultures, they definitely do fall on stereotypes. So that was something that I really wanted to avoid. Even if some stereotypes, I think, have basis in real life, I really wanted to just avoid them because I know how harmful they can be, especially, you know, for, you know, young adults who are growing up without a lot of media representation, not a lot of positive media representation at all. I definitely wanted my book to, you know, let those people know that they are seen, that I see them, that, you know, this is something to be celebrated and to be adored. So that was something that I was really conscious of when I was writing. And I think it wasn't too difficult for me because I love Pakistani culture so much. So it was really just everything that I was writing was coming from this place of love and, you know, this place of appreciation. So it really helped me stay authentic and stay positive.
No. And I saw that or read that so clearly in the novel, and kudos to you for that, because it kind of echoes in many respects what I've seen with many of the historical Turkish dramas like Derviş Ertuğrul.
Because
one of the things about that show that's still amazing, it's amazing on many levels, obviously, but one of the things that stands mm-hmm. out in my mind is the fact that they really immerse you in that environment, in that culture, in that place. You get
Definitely.
To see the food, you get to see the production of carpets. You get to see the people training. You get a real sense of who these people are because you spend time with them. And the way you've written this novel is that you get to spend time with the characters here. And we're actually going to get to the story in a moment. But again, it's so rare that we get to see someone take the time, or we see someone take the time, like yourself, I should say, who's going to go in and say, listen, you know what? It's not just background flavor, so to speak. Look, I'm a huge fan of Star Wars, but one of the things that George Lucas always talked about was that he wanted to give hints of things, but he never let you linger in those places. Your novel allows us to linger, and we really get a sense of this world. So was that something you really kind of said, look, I'm going full in on this, and I'm going to take my time, and the pace I'm setting is so you feel immersed?
Yeah, definitely. I really wanted to create, you know, an immersive world. I love, you know, getting lost in a story and feeling really, you know, that sense of timelessness and that sense of travel while you're reading, where you're reading a book and you don't even realize an hour has passed by and you feel like you've gone on, you know, a little mental vacation or something like that. So I love that experience as a reader. So when I was writing this novel, that was something that I really wanted to replicate. And so a lot of the little details that I include in the novel are, you know, trying to help create that experience for the reader. That was also why I was really adamant that I wanted to include, you know, specific Urdu words or, mm-hmm. you know, specific Islamic jargon. You know, even if not every reader can understand them, I feel like it really helped create the sense of the world.
Definitely, definitely. And I think oftentimes there's this sense that people can't keep pace, or there's an underestimation of what people can actually absorb. And especially
Definitely.
With the young people, they think, oh, okay, we have to spoon feed everything to them. There's a glossary at the back of the book, or we're going to use, you know, common 21 language and terminology and catchphrases in the novels. And I find that so off-putting, and it takes you out of there completely. You just don't feel like you're part of that world. So I'm so happy you decided not to go that route. And you gave more credit to the readers than a lot of people do.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it's a disservice to, you know, spoon feed readers everything. I know as a reader, I hate when, you know, writers do that, because I feel like a lot of the fun about reading is that you're learning so many new things. And I personally love reading about, you know, different cultures, all these things. So I find it so fun when I can look up, you know, words that I'm unfamiliar with, and it just grows my knowledge. So I definitely think that readers can appreciate that.
Well, let's talk about the story itself and the lady or the lion. Obviously,
yeah.
There's somewhat of a pull from the lady or the tiger. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with that that tale, can you give us a little bit about that? And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, I hope. But I think, again, your story is so uniquely woven that I'm reluctant to say it's inspired by, but obviously there's a fun kind of connection to that tale.
Yeah, definitely. So The Lady or the Tiger by Frank R. Stockton is actually a short story that I read in my AP language class when I was in high school. And from the onset, once I read it, I was immediately compelled by it. It basically tells the story of this country where the justice system is based off of a tribunal. And the accused is brought in front of two doors. Behind one is a lady, behind one is a tiger. And the accused doesn't know what is behind which door. And basically, the accused gets to choose their own fate. And in the short story, it's about a princess who falls in love. And the lover is eventually brought to trial. And she finds out who is behind which door. And she basically tells him which door to go to. So that's the gist of the short story.
So you did a great job without revealing too much or anything really about the novel itself. But we're going to get into some of the, you know, finer details, because I think, you know, our listeners deserve something more than just discussions about the Eternals and Bollywood and things of that nature. But the land itself of Maghazar, and my pronunciation might be off. I am half Pakistani, but my mother's from Czechoslovakia, so I'll use that as an excuse to kind of allow me some deference with respect to mispronunciation. But let's talk about the land itself and what's happening, because right from the beginning, we're thrown right into what's happening there. And I really love the fact that there's not much buildup. I mean, yes, there's a buildup with respect to the world, but things happen right away.
Yeah. So I definitely wanted to start the story off at, you know, the right place. I didn't want it to, you know, be slow from the beginning because I knew I'd have to spend a lot of time with world building. So I wanted the action to start right away. And so the story begins with there's four foreign ambassadors being allowed entrance into our protagonist, Zerfenae, into her country. And for this for the first time in, like, centuries that they've allowed foreigners into her country. And they're basically there to negotiate peace and to help avoid war.
And you see, when you have that kind of setup, it's already intriguing on the surface. For those of you who say that, look, politics and fantasy don't work, and you always go back to the prequels of Star Wars and say, no, it never works. No, it can work. And Amna's actually shown that it can. And I think one of the main reasons, aside from the incredibly immersive experience, is these characters. And you mentioned our lead protagonist. So talk about her, because she's a very interesting, compelling character who I feel is kind of pulled in different directions, and there are certain expectations placed on her. She feels like she has to comport herself in a particular fashion, but there's definitely a sincerity there as well that I wholly appreciate. So talk about that. She's got, you know, these expectations because of her role as a princess, but at the same time, she is very, very true to what she believes in and what's important to her as well.
Yeah, definitely. So Zerfenae, our protagonist, is this very, you know, proud, spoiled princess. She was orphaned when she was a baby, so she was raised by her grandparents, who are the king and queen of Margazar. And, you know, they really spoiled her and coddled her growing up. But even so, she's, you know, so fiercely loyal to her people and her country, and she really takes her role as a princess very seriously, to the point where a lot of times it's a major frustration for her that, you know, people don't take her as seriously as she'd like to be taken. A lot of times she's sort of brushed off as, you know, just the beloved princess. You know, they'll love her, but they don't really expect her to take care of anyone or to take charge. But that's something that she definitely puts on herself. She really wants to, you know, be the best princess that she can to these people that she knows that one day she'll be the queen of. So she, even though her grandparents, you know, try to keep her away from the politics side, they try to, you know, coddle her in that sense and not get her involved in anything. But she really takes the initiative to get involved with the politics, get involved with the ambassadors and negotiations, and really do her own, you know, work to figure out what's going on and what's the best course of action for her people and what would be the best course of action to avoid this impending war. And that's actually something that I really love about Zerfenae is, you know, she really takes this initiative, and she's so, I feel like she's a very emotional person. Whatever she does very intensely and, you know, with her whole heart. So that's something that I had a really fun time writing.
Well, as we head out, what's on tap for you with respect to the novel? And now that you're, you know, an author, you're in that space, and you were all worried about, you know, getting there early and getting there young and all that, you know, and now that's done. The ship has sailed. You're in now. What's on tap for you next?
Yeah, so I definitely feel like now that I have my foot in the door, it feels like, you know, the whole world is open to me. I feel like I can sort of accomplish anything, that I have so many opportunities to do all these things that I had always, you know, spent my entire childhood dreaming about. So that's definitely something really special for me. So currently I'm actually working on the sequel for The Lady of the Lion. So I can't really share anything about that yet because it would be very spoilery. Mm-hmm. But the sequel is projected to release a year after The Lady of the Lion comes out this July. So you can look out for that next July.
Okay. And the book is due for release on June 22nd. So still time to order.
It's actually July 20th. 20th now.
Oh, it got moved.
It got
pushed
back a little. Yeah.
Okay. I was just looking at the review copy. So, okay. Still, I mean, you know, it works for me either way because it's well worth the wait. I mean, I'm lucky I already have it, of course. I don't think there are any changes in it.
Thank you.
But by the way, I love the cover too. Who did the cover on the...
Thank you so much. So I actually got a Pakistani painter, Asrar Farooqi, to do the cover.
Okay.
He made this gorgeous landscape painting for me after I sort of described the story and the world for him. And I'm so happy with the way it came out.
Yeah. Again, like I said, you're basically here, you know, I guess you could say bucking up against every type of stereotype you can imagine. And when I pick up a novel like this, like literally it's just, it's beautiful when you read it, it's beautiful with respect to the cover, and the characters are so rich. I'm glad you're writing the sequel. No, like I told you, or I said during the segment, that there were no sequels. There were no, you know, other ideas going in. Hey, a story like this, you got to have more, right?
Yeah. Again, thank you so much.
No problem. Again, Amna Qureshi, The Lady or the Lion. You're always welcome back on Fictional Frontiers, Amna.
Thank you so much.